Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
Senate Democrats are all but powerless to keep Judge Amy Coney Barrett off the Supreme Court. Barrett was questioned about abortion rights, Obamacare, guns, and election disputes. She declined to answer questions on some issues she has expressed personal opinions on in the past, such as abortion rights, or on what she would do regarding other matters likely to come before the Supreme Court. My guest is Harold Krent, a professor at the Chicago Kent College of Law. What did we learn about Judge Barrett from the hearings?
We've learned very little about Judge Barrett, but we've mostly learned that the senators are using this nomination process as a way to reach the American people and influence them for the election. That's what they focused on, and both Republicans and Democrats are using spin to try to get voters on their side.
Judge Barrett has refused to answer numerous questions about many different topics. Has this become the norm for Supreme Court nominations hearings, or is she taking it even a step further?
Unfortunately, she's very close to the norm. I mean, the perfecting the art of the non-answer is something that she's taken perhaps to a different level, but we've seen that in the last several nominations, and unfortunately in this age of partisanship, the non-answer is the one that gets by and doesn't antagonize any of the senators who are asking questions. There are a couple of clues that have come through. To give one prominent example, Judge Barrett said that the precedent of Brown versus Board of Education, recognizing that separate is not equal, is entrenched into our system, has been accepted, and should never be second-guessed. And she refused to do that for Roe versus Wade. She said that despite the fact that the court has reconsidered it and affirmed Roe versus Wade, the fact that there's so much discussion about it means that it's not entrenched. And so her theory, which is a little bizarre, is that if the precedent is accepted, there's no reason to reexamine it, which of course is obvious. But if it's not accepted, then you can reexamine it. So her answers, even in contrast to those of now Justice Kavanaugh just a couple of years ago, suggest a willingness to reconsider Roe versus Wade. So I would consider that the biggest clue that she let drop today in discussion so far.
She talked with Lindsey Graham at the beginning about precedent and what she called a super precedent. First of all, is super precedent something you teach in law school nowadays?
So super precedent is not something that we have historically taught or knew anything about. And indeed, Justice Kavanaugh used the expression precedent on precedent, which I had not been aware of until he used it. And so what these jurors are doing are trying to suggest that there are some precedents, yes, that we should reexamine, and some precedents that are beyond reproach. And there is a consensus in the academy and probably amongst the court that the justices should be willing to reconsider constitutional precedents more readily than statutory precedents, because Congress can always change a statutory interpretation by the court that they disagree with, and Congress can't do that with the court's interpretation of the Constitution.
What do you make of the fact that she was willing to say that Casey was precedent but not Roe v. Wade?
Well, my interpretation of her answer is suggesting that despite Casey, there's still so much discussion and so much hand-wringing about the status of Casey and Roe versus Wade that it's not entrenched precedent, which to me was a clear signal, maybe not in the first case she hears, maybe not in the second, but at some point she would be willing to overturn Roe versus Wade itself.
Have you ever heard that definition of precedent before?
Again, it makes no sense to me at all, because the point is, if it's a circle, it's soliloquy, because if people then are willing to overturn precedent, suddenly it becomes eligible for overturning, which is no rule at all. So her rule of stare decisis or precedent is far weaker than others on the court, even weaker than that of at least that professed, you know, by Justice Kavanaugh just a couple years ago. Maybe she misspoke, but it sounded to me as if she said if it's a controversial precedent, it's fair game.
Let's go on to Obamacare. And she has written about Justice Roberts' opinion in Obamacare and criticized it. What do you take away from what she said about any case of Obamacare coming before her?
Well, she clearly indicated that she would not recuse herself, and I don't think the rules currently would force her to recuse herself at all. She did give a little bit of clue by saying that the precise issue that would be before the court in early November, right after the election, dealing with Obamacare, has to do with the constitutional doctrine called severability, which asks, how do you ascertain Congress's underlying intent if one part of a statute is deemed unconstitutional? And that really, on that issue, hangs the fate of Obamacare. And she said, look, that wasn't at issue when I wrote the article, and I've done no writing on it. It's a separate issue. And if I'm on the court and the issue comes up, I'm going to have to grapple with it for the first time. And that's something that suggests at least that she is not perhaps made up her decision, and that her writings would not convince her that she should vote to hold unconstitutional. I'm skeptical, but that's at least a tea leaf from what she said in the hearings.
I've been talking to Professor Harold Krent of the Chicago Kent College of Law. What was your take on her description of when she would recuse herself from a case? Isn't it up to the justices themselves to decide that?
There are some clear directives in terms of like financial involvement that would require a judge to recuse themselves. I believe there's also a rule if you had been involved in the case previously as, for instance, an executive branch officer. So we've had justices recuse themselves when they hear a case that challenged something in which they were involved in when they were in the Justice Department. But there is a wide gray area. And so what I think she was saying, and I think with some justification, that at least the examples suggested to her by the senators were in that gray area, fact-specific, and likely she wouldn't have to recuse herself. I mean, the one issue that was raised, which shed some light on this, is she's been asked several times whether she promised the president to rule in a particular way on a given case, because that, of course, is what President Trump has made it seem like, and she clearly stated that that was not the case, because that would have strengthened the case for recusal. But on the question of the constitutionality of Obamacare or what would happen if there was a challenge to President Trump's election come November, she clearly said, I have made no promises, I have no pre-commitments about ruling in any way on those cases, which again would signal that she doesn't believe she would ever need to recuse herself in those settings.
I remember that Justice Scalia refused to recuse himself from a case involving Dick Cheney, even though he was friendly with Dick Cheney and had gone hunting with him even. There's no one, the Chief Justice is not looking at the justices and saying, oh, you have to recuse yourself in this case.
No, that's right. And again, an issue might arise, but I don't think this particular set of circumstances dictates a need to for any kind of recusal. So I do think that Judge Barrett was on strong ground in thinking, you know, in saying or expressing her belief that, yes, you might have to recuse yourself in some cases, for instance, if there was a case in which she was involved in the Seventh Circuit. And just because of this politically charged atmosphere near an election, I don't think that necessarily would force her hand to recuse herself from any kind of controversial case involving President Trump, you know, or involving Obamacare.
At one point, I believe it was Senator Durbin was asking her about decisions that she took part in at the Seventh Circuit. And in one decision, she was in dissent in saying that she thought that a felon should have the right to own a gun.
Her rulings on the Seventh Circuit are comprehensive, though they haven't touched upon many of the constitutionally charged issues of the day. In one of the cases that she has ruled upon, she dissented in a case in which the court held that a nonviolent felon did not have the right to possess a gun. And she thought that as an individual right back in 1789, she believes the Second Amendment is an individual right that should give a wide ambit or wide possibility for people to then enjoy that right, even felons who are nonviolent felons. So that she signaled there a very strong interest in maintaining a robust Second Amendment. And of course, the Republicans were delighted to highlight that as a way of trying to embrace people who like guns in this country to vote Republican come the election. So, you know, you might ask yourself if there's a Second Amendment right to for felons to own guns, then shouldn't there be a right to vote as well? Whether she would agree with that statement, I'm not sure, but we may find out in the future.
Justice Scalia was her mentor, and she has said that she will follow in Justice Scalia's footsteps. She says you're not going to get a Justice Scalia, you're going to get a Justice Barrett. Yeah, she's an originalist, a textualist. What does that tell you?
It tells us not everything, but it tells us that, like Justice Scalia, she'd be very skeptical of sort of the broad, open-ended rights that have been read into the Due Process Clause, namely the right to privacy and the right to bodily autonomy. Because if the right was not clearly articulated at the time of the framing, she'd be more skeptical. I mean, there are open-ended constitutional provisions like free from an unreasonable search and seizure. You have to read some kind of evolution into those words because, you know, there was no internet back in the time of the framing. And so like Justice Scalia, she might be turn out to be more liberal in some criminal justice questions. But when you come to rights, she'll be very strict in trying to understand what a right is and what is not. So she would probably tend to be skeptical of many of the rights that the courts over the last 30 years have recognized, you know, such as, again, bodily autonomy, privacy. And we're not sure, but she might be very skeptical about affirmative action as well. And as we all know, there has been some very close votes in affirmative action over the past couple of years.
Justice Scalia thought that Roe was wrongly decided. He was in the minority in the Obergefell case, the same-sex marriage case, and he voted against Obamacare. So can we take it that she'll be on the same side of those issues, or is that drawing too much?
Clearly, with respect to the, you know, rights of gays and transgender, there are reasons for deep concern. Her view would be that the Equal Protection Clause should be quite limited. Her view of marriage is very historically based. So her votes would likely line up with Justice Scalia in that case. And I think the Obamacare case is really different. It had to do with the scope of the Commerce Clause in part over the insurance markets. And I don't think that lines up as neatly with in terms of Justice Scalia's originalism. But what I do think that she, even more so than Justice Scalia, would probably believe in a vigorous free exercise clause, which would probably suggest that the government cannot place sort of mainstream responsibilities and obligations on those exercising religious rights. So what happens if there's a conflict between the taxing power in a church, or if there's a conflict between a right of non-discrimination against gays or people of different races against the religious rights? She might change the scales and vote that that the government cannot impose such burden upon those exercising their religions. And that would, I think, cause much disruption in our society.
How do you think she handled the questions and, you know, her demeanor?
You know, she's very calm. She's very self-assured. She's clearly confident in her own abilities and in her experience that she will be able to handle the job. And in terms of traditional notions of qualifications, she's clearly very well qualified for the job. But she will move the court. She will move the court even more to the right than it is now. And part of the skirmishing that I saw both yesterday and today is preparing the ground for a possible fight over the structure of the Supreme Court in the future, about whether with these last two appointments and the sort of hypocrisy of the Republicans, if the Democrats get the Senate and the presidency, will they try to alter the court in some way to sort of fight back against at this sort of incursion or seeming incursion by the Republicans.
Any final thoughts, Hal?
Much of the questioning today by both Republicans and Democrats, say by Senator Cruz on the Republican side, Senator Whitehouse on the Democratic side, they didn't even ask questions of Judge Barrett. I mean, they clearly were using their time, as is their prerogative, to talk directly to the American people about, on the one hand, Republican values of religion and gun ownership, on the other hand, the Democratic values of Affordable Care Act and so forth, because, again, this is just so clearly an opportunity to try to influence voting as it continues up until November, so that in some ways, even the senators themselves didn't take this seriously as an opportunity to grill and find out more about Judge Barrett.
The way these hearings are now structured and the way the nominees don't answer questions, is there any point in having these hearings anymore?
No, it's a great question, and the function of the hearings has changed, you know, over time. I think there is a necessity to do, for a period, to do due diligence, to find what somebody has written, to find out if there's any kind of whiff of impropriety in their background. So the idea of having something, a waiting period to allow for investigation, I think is critical. But I'm not sure that there's much function in these sort of showboat hearings after the nomination, because, again, what we've seen so far is pure posturing by both sides.
Thanks for being on the Bloomberg Law Show, Hal. That's Harold Krant, a professor at the Chicago Kent College of Law.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Monday's session was primarily opening statements. Barrett cast herself as a judge who puts her personal preferences aside, saying the public shouldn't expect courts to resolve policy disputes or make value judgments and that judges should not try to do so. My guest is Professor Carl Tobias of the University of Richmond Law School. What did you think about the opening statements? And let's start with the Democratic senators basically talking about what effect her nomination would have on the Obamacare decision coming up after the election.
Well, they did talk about that because that's front and center for the elections that are coming up. But I think more fundamentally, they said that basically what Republicans were doing with this nomination was directly opposed to what they did in 2016 as a matter of principle. And I think they're correct about that. Basically, that Senator McConnell and all the Republicans wouldn't allow Merrick Garland, the distinguished nominee of President Barack Obama, to even have a hearing or even meet with him, given the fact that it was 10 months before the end of his presidency when the vacancy occurred. Here, we're 22 days away from the election. And so, as a matter of consistency, the Republicans have been inconsistent. And so, I think the Democrats are questioning legitimacy of what is going on. Secondly, that it's been extremely rushed to move forward. The president didn't consult at all with any of the Democratic senators, as best we can tell. And so I think they had those kinds of questions. But then they went on to talk about, as you say, the Affordable Care Act. And basically, I think they're concerned about how she might address that issue that's before the court in short order after the elections. And they're concerned about being in a pandemic and having people lose their health care, especially people with pre-existing conditions. So I think that's what they're talking about. And I think a number of them also said that they would intend to talk about her record and how she might resolve certain cases, her judicial philosophy, those types of things.
What was the focus of the Republicans? Did the Republicans have as much of a centered approach as the Democrats did?
Well, a number of them talked about and accused Democrats of using a religious test for office, which I think is a perversion of what Democrats have been trying to do with all nominees. So I don't think that was persuasive for people who actually watched the hearings over time, as I did. And I think, though, that all the Democrats seem to be saying they will not in any way do that. But we'll see what the questions are. And it's a very delicate, difficult kind of issue to find out what a nominee's philosophy might be in a particular case. And so it may be that certain cases touch on questions of religion. Of course, they do. Religious freedom is on the docket in many cases before the Supreme Court. So I don't know that they can probe that without that kind of accusation coming from the Republicans. But even in the earlier hearing for the Seventh Circuit, for Judge Barrett when she was a nominee, I don't think anyone really meant to in any way impose some kind of religious test in violation of the Constitution. So they're really talking past one another, it seems to me. So hopefully there'll be less partisan sniping and maybe more attention to the process as we go forward. But again, I do think that it is rushed, and we'll see how the questioning goes and what the nominees' answers are. But there was certainly a lot of back and forth between the senators on both sides of the aisle on a whole number of issues, some of which seemed extraneous and some of which hopefully would go to the kinds of issues that should be raised here about how the nominee views her responsibility as a life-tenured member of the Supreme Court.
Now, let's talk about her statement. She said that courts should not try to make policy decisions. That's for the political branches. What did you make of that statement of hers?
Well, I suppose that's one thing that Democrats might ask her about. What does she mean? Because, as I think they pointed out, the policy that was made was the ACA, which passed, and despite President Trump and Republican efforts to gut that legislation, they can't get it through Congress. And so now, despite their protestations, they're seeking a verdict from the Supreme Court that would change that. And so they're doing the very thing they accuse Democrats of doing, using the courts for policymaking. So I think we'll have to see what she really means by that. In fairness, I think she's saying we don't make policy, but of course that's just not true, because they will make policy if they were to find the law unconstitutional and strike it down. It will make policy one way or another for 130 million people who have pre-existing conditions, and so we'll see if they probe that. I expect they will.
Supreme Court nominees are often asked about respect for precedent. Explain why that's particularly true of Judge Barrett.
Well, I believe she's written a number of law review articles about precedent and has taken a view that is different from some present justices on the Supreme Court. She seems to, according to her critics, respect precedent less than other justices on the Supreme Court. And certainly Justice Thomas has been a pretty strong critic of precedent and saying most prior decisions are up for reexamination. Chief Justice Roberts, I think, is more measured about that and says we ought to be very cautious for reasons of institutional respect from the citizens when we change a precedent, especially one that's longstanding. But more specifically, examples would be Roe versus Wade, or there was some mention of privacy cases like the case from Connecticut in the 60s that recognized the notion of a right to privacy. And of course, Brown versus Board, and a number of other precedents. And so I think there's a feeling among some Democratic senators that she is less concerned about honoring longstanding precedents, or to flip it around, more willing to overturn them. Those questions will be asked.
Explain this, Carl, because the Supreme Court does overturn its own precedent. I mean, we saw that a couple of years ago when they overturned, a 40-year-old precedent in the Union case. It just seems as if all this stress on precedent is sort of elusive, because they do overturn their own precedent.
Well, they do, but, you know, there are ways to talk about that. And I think one measure is how long the precedent has existed. Another measure is how strong the precedent is. There's some discussion of something being a super precedent and that type of thing. But there are notions, especially of time's passage, how central that precedent is to jurisprudence. But you're right. I mean, if the court's made an earlier decision that's wrong, then I think justices, some feel that it should be changed. You don't cling to precedents that now are completely outmoded. But Chief Justice Roberts, I think, would say you shouldn't too readily overturn a precedent, especially a new precedent, say, that's a couple of years old, or make a dramatic change only because the composition of the court has changed. For example, President Trump will likely appoint three new justices. Just because the court's composition has changed doesn't mean that precedent should be struck down without seriously considering them.
She was a clerk of Justice Scalia and said that she would follow Justice Scalia. What does that mean?
Well, that's a difficult notion because he wrote decisions and joined opinions, you know, over three decades in many areas. And I think she would, I wouldn't put words in her mouth. Well, here, I think they'll ask her about that. But I think the notions of originalism and textualism and those types of ideas, perhaps, and maybe the notion we were talking about earlier that judges shouldn't be policymakers. There were many areas in which, you know, he made decisions, and I don't think she was saying that she would necessarily follow every one, but kind of the general outline. But we'll hear about that. I assume that there'll be questions that go to that.
Just give me your basic take on her statement. What was she trying to get at? What impressed you? What didn't impress you?
Well, she really didn't say a whole lot that's new. We knew she had said earlier in the Rose Garden that she was, a proponent and took views very similar to Justice Scalia, her mentor, as she said specifically. And so then the question is, you know, how that will play out. She also said clearly again today, as she has earlier, that she doesn't think judges are policymakers. But as I said, I don't think that tells us very much because they make policy in all kinds of areas and deciding all kinds of questions. So then the question is how senators will question her and drill down and be more specific and maybe bring up particular areas of law or how she intends to apply rules as the precedent. I think all of those questions are legitimate ones that will be asked and try to move from the more general statements that she has there to something more specific and concrete.
Thanks, Carl. That's Professor Carl Tobias of the University of Richmond Law School.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Hurd, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.